This immensity of early 21st century finance dwarfs the comparative expansion of railroad mileage, debt, and power in the 1850s and 1860s. Still, there is an unfortunate parallel to railroading's domination of federal, state, and local politics, as well as to its ability to long fend off most attempts at regulation. Financial services enjoyed a kindred position in the 1980s and 1990s. As innovation, computerization, and broad deregulation opened up grand vistas, politicians whose eyes saw contributor dollar signs at the very mention of names such as Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and Goldman Sachs kept day-to-day regulators saluting respectfully. The Federal Reserve, long the principal shepherd of the banking sector, became financial services' most important advocate. The board's anxiousness to see American financial services giants emerge to challenge Japanese and European behemoths such as Mitsubishi, Credit Suisse, and Deutsche Bank expressed itself in thinly disguised collaboration. Potential stock market constraints like higher margin requirements were left unused. Putative financial collapses were transformed into expensive rescues. Assets losing air were reinflated, and bubbles were rarely and belatedly noticed, and never, ever pricked. Even the railroads had not done so well. From 2001 to 2004, and especially after September 11th, the Federal Reserve managed an economic architectural triumph on the scale of the Great Pyramids at Luxor. The financial and real estate base of American wealth was rebuilt, shifting primacy from stocks back to home values. In many ways, the rescue was extraordinary. The downside, obviously, lies in the debt used to bring it about. Perhaps we can now take a better inventory. The national debt, having been expanded to pay for stimulus, must make the list. So, too, consumer borrowing and mortgage debt. The expansion of corporate debt, part of it refinancing at the lowest rates in nearly half a century, helped to rebuild stock market capitalization. As for the incredible expansion of financial sector debt, some of it doubtless strengthened Adam Smith's invisible hand, and a considerable amount propelled Warren Buffett's invisible foot. The point is that easy private credit became public policy, and to a unique degree. However, with so much new debt created, the stimulus per dollar showed a significant decline. Although economists used different yardsticks and ratios, the message was essentially the same. From 1988 to 2000, the ratio of non-financial debt to GDP had stayed at 1.8 to 1. But then from 2001 to 2003, the ratio widened. $4.2 trillion more in debt turned out to add only $1.3 trillion in new GDP. In 2005, another economist acknowledged diminishing marginal returns on credit, in that it takes more and more debt now to fuel each marginal dollar of consumption. It now takes 11 cents of new debt to generate each additional dollar of consumption. That's up from just 3 cents in 1992. The burdens on consumers, meanwhile, became heavier. In the first quarter of 2005, households paid out 10.35% of their income to service mortgages, the highest since 1991. At 13.4%, the overall consumer and mortgage household debt service ratio, debt payments to disposable income, was at an all-time high. The broader ratio of household outlays for all financial obligations, adding rent, auto lease payments, homeowners insurance, and property taxes, was 18.4%, just under the 2001 to 2003 peak. With respect to automobile loans, some 40% of those buying new cars with the zero financing of 2003 to 2004 were trading in vehicles on which they owed more than the auto was then worth. The other emerging predicament was global. The massive current account deficit, which reflected a United States living beyond its means, and the uncertain duration of the unusual willingness of Asian central banks to fund it by buying and holding its federal debt.